Well, June has seen hot and humid weather across Wisconsin, and then it was cold a little bit, or it's been cool a little bit. So we seem to be settling down a little bit, I think. That said, cities in the western U.S. have been smashing high temperatures. They've been setting records left and right, I think, quite recently. We'll talk about some of that and, of course, our own Wisconsin weather with our two guests. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, professor in the department, UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be here.
John Martin with us as well, a professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW. John, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry.
Well, there's plenty to talk about. We'll weigh in with them on the hot weather, plus we'll explain a unique weather phenomenon that can happen this time of year. As always, we'll be taking your weather questions, so I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Let's go to Wisconsin first. Our weather has been kind of all over the map, hasn't it? This month of June, very warm temperatures. Then we've had cool temperatures.
Yeah, our average high right now is 80 degrees, and we haven't approached that in a few days, and we won't for a few more. So today we're struggling maybe to get to 70. I don't know if we will get to 70.
Yeah, it's cool out there right now.
And
yeah.
I think we were in the high 60s yesterday. So these are exceptionally cool days. And I was surprised getting ready to come over today, thinking about the month of June. I thought to myself, come on, it's got to be cooler than average and probably way wetter than average. It is wetter than average by a couple of inches, so that part was right. But it's 3.3 degrees warmer than average for an average June.
I was surprised at that, too.
Can you believe that?
And both the maximum and the minimum are above average.
Yeah, it's just so weird. Yeah, and we only had two stretches. We had the 3rd and the 4th of June were 87, I think, and then we had the 10th to the 17th, which was pretty warm. Other than that, we haven't had any. Yeah. That was enough.
That was enough.
Yeah, I was really surprised, too.
You see up on Facebook and different people commenting, what is there? Where's this climate change business? It's too cold. I've had to have the furnace on.
It's certainly been true around here.
It just goes to show, you have to go back to the data, to the observations.
That's right.
You can't go on your impression because our impressions are often wrong.
Always wrong. Almost.
Well, Ken.
Well, maybe yours are.
Mine are always wrong. Someone very close to me continuously tells me that.
Ken in Mayville has something for us. Ken, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'm sure this is going to be a topic that comes up quite a bit. But some of those storms a couple weeks ago that were up north. My mother-in-law lives up near Wild Rose, and we went up there that night shortly after everything had hit, and it was absolutely a disaster area. I hadn't heard anything about that particular area being affected, although there were, in her house, looks like a house in the middle of a pile of pickup sticks. Luckily it survived, but there were some spots that looked like tornadoes, but the trees were all sheared off at, 10 feet above, whereas and there was no inner pathway of other trees around. So I just didn't know if that was straight line winds or if anything had been reported on those.
Yeah, I don't know officially what the word is, but all of those characteristics that you just mentioned suggest to me straight line winds, the derecho type of event. Maybe notably the sawing the trees off 10 or so feet above the ground. That's one of the characteristics. And the fact that you can't find any evidence of any kind of rotation in the debris, that it hasn't been left in a rotated, setting. So that's probably what it was. And it's consistent with the fact that at that time we were having pretty heavy convective storms in the northern part of the state. And it seems to me the further north you go in June and early July, the more likely when you're in convection, the more likely you are that you have straight line winds. It's just amazing, isn't it?
All right.
And you guys,
it's absolutely incredible.
absolutely amazing. In a recent piece in the State Journal, you guys wrote about derecho, that weather phenomenon.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about what are the conditions that create that kind of thing and so forth.
Yeah, good.
Okay.
John,
why don't you go first?
Well, we have
we'll add to it, right?
One thing that both the derecho and the tornado share is they develop in an environment where there's deep convective storms, thunderstorm-type activity. And the straight-line wind type, the derecho-type disasters, come from the fact that the thunderstorms don't have sufficient rotation to develop a tornado. And that usually means, it's not always the case, but it usually means they're developing in an environment, a large-scale environment, where the flow is pretty much from one direction throughout the whole column of the atmosphere. And often from the northwest, like these were, I think, that Ken was talking about. And so the thunderstorm environment allows for a lot of vertical mixing of air from one level to another. And so part of that can be mixing of air from very high altitudes down to the ground. And that air at high altitude has a lot faster wind speed. And that wind speed doesn't change just because you dramatically move the air down to the surface. And it hits the ground with that forward speed, and it does a lot of damage.
you don't want to be standing outside.
You don't want to be standing right here.
No, it takes the paint off of barns. Yeah. That's what I've heard. You know, people have said they drive by a barn after one of these derechos, and this paint been ripped off.
Yeah. It's just steady winds from up where planes are flying.
And how common or uncommon are they?
I don't know how to put that into a number, but I would say that, as I mentioned it to the caller, I think when you get to mid-June to about mid to late July, they're quite common types of heavy weather in the northern plain states. So I don't know if that means they happen 60% of the time when you have a thunderstorm or something like that. That's probably an exaggeration. But when you have damage to timber and damage to structures, I would say that some large fraction of the time in this part of the world and further north, it's from straight-line winds.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. In our textbook, we had a diagram of where they tend to occur, and I just can't picture it in my mind right now.
I would think, I don't know. I was thinking August maybe because that's, I think, our hottest month, isn't it?
That's close to it. It might be the first time we're starting to turn down.
You mentioned June and July, and I immediately thought, why not August? But
yeah.
You need to pull down that jet stream.
Right,
air.
And the jet is a lot further north the further you go into August and early September. Yeah. So that element's missing.
Okay, yeah. that makes sense. Yeah. Well, last week, the Southwest U.S. had the worst heat wave. You know, it was 119 degrees in Phoenix, 117 in Las Vegas, and those are those tied the all-time highs.
But it's a dry heat.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah, right.
Just a walk on a parking lot.
You know, obviously heat is, they're sort of accustomed to it, but how unusual is this very hot weather for that area?
I don't know.
If it's record-setting, then it's got to be very unusual.
Yeah. You approach the record maybe somewhat frequently every fifth year or so, but to actually break it is unusual.
You're tired, then it's not.
So it's fairly unusual. Phoenix Airport has extra long runways because they know they need to have a really long taxi at high speed to get enough lift under the wings to take off, and they had a couple of days where they couldn't do it because the air is so thin at those high temperatures. They just said, we can't get our aircraft off the ground. Aerodynamically. Yeah. And that happens once in a while for them. But to have it a couple of days in a row is very unusual.
Very interesting.
So I wonder who picks the tab up on that, because that's still a weather event. So if you have to overlay, then the airlines would not do it.
That's
right?
Probably
they
right.
They say it's a weather event.
That's probably right.
Think of that.
Carrie in Sparta, we'll go to you next and then to Ann. But Carrie, you're first. Hi.
Hi. I was in a storm in 1975. That went through Phillips, and it lasted an hour and a quarter, and it was a straight line wind of at least 200 miles an hour, and most of the trees there got mowed over.
Wow.
And I was also in a downdraft storm with no rotation, and what it would do is you could watch the trees. They would bend right over in middle of the tree, and they would snap right off, where the trunk is, 10 feet off the ground, and it was just such an amazing thing to watch. Trees would go straight down to the ground and go swack, and then the tree would just snap right off.
Wow.
So that was a straight downdraft wind.
Yeah, but that downdraft was probably carrying horizontal wind speed, too. Yeah. I bet you
see that in the storm.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
Usually,
there was no side draft on that one.
Wow.
Yeah, if it's we were talking about the wind patterns of the destructions, and if it's a tornado, it's just random and everything's destroyed and thrown all over the place. In straight line winds, they're all pushed over in one direction. And in a correct. Downdraft wind, you know, like in a microburst, then it's like a spoke pattern in the tree patterns.
That's what we were seeing.
That's what you saw, yeah. Then it was a downdraft.
Kind of like pickup sticks when
and,
you
right,
drop
yeah,
them.
You just drop them and they all just
and
flop,
I think
flop
that
up.
1975 storm was one of the storms that was written up in a paper in the late 70s, a scientific paper that actually reintroduced this notion of derechos, because it came from about the 1880s and then suffered a long period of hibernation as an idea in the central part of North America. But I think it was Rit Carbone, one of our colleagues who works at NCAR, who resurrected the idea. And I believe that 1975 event was part of the analysis that led him to the conclusions.
Ah, very cool.
Yeah, I was right on the Willow Flowage when it went through, right in the middle of it.
Wow.
Oh, it was horrible.
Isn't Phillips where they have that cement park, too?
Yes.
Did that sustain damage on that storm, or...?
Probably.
In that storm, what we were seeing all the way through was just everything was pushed over straight.
Okay, yeah.
Hardly any of the trees were snapped off halfway up. They were all just laid down like pickup sticks and all in a straight line.
That's amazing.
Oh, wow.
All the way from Phillips all the way over past Rhinelander.
And yeah, you know, those derechos, there was one that went from Minnesota all the way to the East Coast.
Yeah,
that was just a couple of years ago.
That's right. And then the famous one, the boundary layer, the boundary waters event from July of 1999 was a huge amount of timber went down in that one.
Yeah. Thanks, Gary. Appreciate your call. I want to give Ann a chance to join us. Ann, your turn. Hi.
Hi, good morning. On Saturday evening after the thunderstorm, a sunset started to appear, and to the north I saw a huge vertical rainbow, and it went just from the low clouds down to the ground. There was no arch or other portions visible, and it was very wide, especially the red band. So I'm wondering, vertical rainbow, what I saw, how unusual is that?
John?
I saw the same thing, and I saw it evolve. I'll say this. I saw it evolve from a classic-looking rainbow to when the backside of the thunderstorm clouds that had kind of spawned it were kind of encroaching upon the rainbow itself, and they cut off the top part of it. So I wonder if we saw the same thing, but at different times. I was lucky enough to see the whole thing evolve, and at the end, I agree, it was like a tree trunk of just rainbow colors, particularly really bright red on one side of the sky. But I think it had been connected to a bigger rainbow earlier than that. That's what I'm guessing.
Wow.
Very unusual. Thank you.
Yeah, it was unusual.
Did you take a photo?
I did, but on my phone. Yeah. So I don't know how good it is.
I've noticed a lot of Facebook photos of double arc ones.
Yeah, that's what it was
in Madison on Saturday.
Yeah, it was dramatic. It was one of the best ones I've ever seen. I happened to be at Lake Union. Not Lake Union.
At the Union?
I can't remember the name of the lake now. It's terrible. But anyway, I saw it come down right into the lake.
So that was really
awesome.
Can't find gold there.
No. Lake Monona it was, yeah.
If you've got a photo, a weather photo, I hope you'll post it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Do that right now. Steve Ackerman and John Martin will be back after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at weather with our two weather guys, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, and of course, Steve's a member of that department as well. Weather question or climate question, I hope you'll join us. And if you have a weather photo, I hope you'll post it up on our Facebook page. We always get great photos every time these guys are on. So post yours on The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. Let's go to Jim in Brookfield next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Good afternoon, gentlemen. I have an astronomical-type climate question. It relates to the solstice. We just had the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. But flipping back to the winter, December 21st, the shortest day of the year, I heard that due to the time the sun sets, it actually gets darker earlier in early December. Not so much length of time, but in early December it gets darker earlier than the actual solstice, December 21st. And I was wondering if you could confirm that, please.
Oh, good question. Now, so the shortest amount of daylight in the Northern Hemisphere does occur on the summer the winter solstice, which is usually around December 20th or 21st. But the latest sunset actually occurs. I mean, the earliest sunset actually occurs in early January, and
the
So it's not a uniform situation where your least hours have to do with the latest sunrise than the earliest sunset. It's kind of skewed off of that.
And so the earliest sunrise is in, the latest sunrise is in early December.
And it has to do with the, you know, the wobbling of the Earth, and it's we're not a circular orbit, we're an eccentric orbit, and we actually rotate in the same we spin in the same direction that we're rotating around the sun, and it's really hard to describe without a ball. And that,
That's true.
Well, is the earliest sunset then in January, or is I heard early December?
The earliest sunset is in January, like January 4th.
Oh, is that right?
Very good.
Yeah. All right. And then it's the same thing around the summer solstice. You know, the summer solstice isn't 12 hours prior to solar noon.
But it's not the earliest sunrise.
It's not the earliest
and
sunrise
the
and the latest
all on
sunset.
The same day. They're
right.
Offset.
They occur differently, mid-June and late June.
All right, there we go. Thanks. It always seems to me like it gets even brighter after the longest day of the year for a few days.
Yeah, I think our latest sunset is what's our date?
Today's
I think it's just happening.
Today,
so I think it was like June 22nd or 20. No, later in June. So this week, I think, is
maybe
our latest sunset. Yeah.
We have some magnificent rainbow photos.
Oh, that is a good one.
This one is from Michael Shatek. Lake Shatek. They had one on Friday and again on Sunday, a double rainbow, and it is a spectacular photo.
Yeah, that is really cool because it's over a lake and you're seeing that reflection of the whole thing in the lake, particularly the bright area underneath that primary rainbow.
Yeah.
Is really cool.
That's awesome.
And then this cloud photo from Isaac from the Edgerton area on June 22nd, Thursday. Mm-hmm.
That looks like a nasty thunderstorm.
Yeah,
the things you want to be at a distance looking.
not underneath. It's a beautiful shot, and then a whole lot of rainbows.
That's kind of what we heard about earlier.
Yeah, right.
Just the part of the rainbow, not the whole thing.
The rest of it's obscured for reasons that I suppose you could figure out, but they don't immediately come apparent.
So that was Gary's photo from Cumberland.
Wow, that's
he had a couple actually. He sent for us, and so some really. And go on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. You don't have to be a Facebook member to see those photos, or if you've got a photo you want to post up there, please go ahead and do it.
Yeah, there are a lot of good rainbow ones there.
Yeah, that's right.
James in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, James.
Hi. So I live on the top of a bluff here in Eau Claire. Well, not really a bluff, but it's a rather good-sized hill, probably 150, 200 feet. It goes down into the Chippewa River, which is a relatively large river that moves pretty quickly. But to my west and north, there is no water to speak of until you get to the St. Croix River, which is about 65 or 70 miles away.
Mm.
I've noticed that there can be a rather large discrepancy in the dew point at my house to my friend's house who lives on the other side of the river. Is that just bad equipment, or does the dew point change that much over that short distance because it's going over a large moving body of water?
It could be both. And so when you're doing the comparison, it would be interesting to segregate it by who's downwind of the river to see if that matters.
Oh, he's almost always downwind.
He's almost always downwind. And is he always higher than you or lower?
No, he's about the same elevation.
And then what about the dew point? Is the dew point usually...
Dew point's generally lower at his house, and it can be significant. It can be as much as 10 degrees.
Oh, I'd bring the two instruments next to each other then.
Yeah.
Calibrate them.
Yeah, that would be
interesting. What I was thinking.
Do that first.
Okay. But the broader question is you can have those kinds of really remarkable dew point differences over short distances. It's not unheard of. In fact, it's probably fairly common in such terrain. As you know, you're near a river and you've got some hills involved, all sorts of variables like that. So it's possible that it's actually real. Though Steve's suggestion's an excellent one, and it seems like it resonates with your own sense. Yeah, I want to see those instruments behaving next to each other, see what happens.
There we go.
Can you,
go ahead, James.
can you make a recommendation or not about a decently priced but relatively accurate dew point measurement in case we want to change our equipment?
Oh, yeah. You know, the price on these weather systems, these home weather systems, are really coming down.
Mine's
pretty old now. It's probably 6-7 years old. It's an Oregon system.
That's what I have. It doesn't give me the dew point. It gives me the relative humidity. So I'd need to get an independent pressure measurement and all that.
Yeah, I'm looking. Yeah, I want the dew point.
Yeah, that's wise. I'd like to do the same thing just to make sure it's working right. But I don't I don't have a suggestion for that. I didn't know there was anything that's along the lines of the Oregon Scientific that actually measures the dew point. That's pretty cool. Well,
yeah, but they have obviously the tables to convert the relative humidity and the temperature to a dew point. So I would think that some of the stations would allow you to.
Like 10, 12 years ago, we were using wet bulb thermometers.
Right.
Yeah, you are dedicated if you're using a wet bulb thermometer.
What is that?
So it's a it's a way of measuring the amount of water vapor in the atmosphere, and called the wet bulb temperature. And so you have two thermometers next to each other, and one has a wick on it, and you wet it. And then you spin it around, and then that evaporative cooling cools down the thermometer with the wick in it. And then when it reaches a steady state, you know what the wet bulb temperature is, which allows you to convert to, with the temperature, allows you to convert to dew point, relative humidity, and things like that.
Whoa!
So, but you have to go outside and sling that thing around.
You better have a good shoulder. I don't right now.
So, I mean, you know, is there anything that's... We were told that when we were going through school that was a relatively accurate way to do it.
That is. And if you still have that, you know, another way to do it would be to reference the two instruments to the wet bulb temperature. So you could make the wet bulb temperature at your house and then convert it to a dew point or a relative humidity and then go over to his house so you don't have to move the instruments and do the same thing and see if you're agreeing with the wet bulb temperature to what amount. If one's dry biased or moist biased.
But I would change the wick just to be absolutely sure.
Well, that was a loan thing a long time ago, and we don't have it.
You don't have that.
I don't have it anymore. Well, maybe somebody else has got an instrument that does it. If you do, give us a call and let us know what you got.
Yeah.
1-800-642-1234. Give a call. James, you had something else to follow up? Nope, he hung up. All right. Join in whether or not you have one of those instruments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Miller Show Facebook page. Anders emailed to say, it always seems like La Crosse is a few degrees warmer than other parts of Wisconsin. Is that true? And if so, why?
Yeah, no, I'd like to look at the data that.
I kind of
remember, you know, this coming up like 8 years ago, it seemed like a lot of people would call up and say that.
Yeah.
And I don't remember what we concluded. But again, it's one of those things where, you know, it's what does it feel like or what do we think? But you really got to go look at the data. And see,
I would want to look at this thing. I'd feel the same way that I think the La Crosse reporting station is in a region of a little bit of local orography. So there may be days where that's definitely true. But I don't know if it's systematically true.
Yeah. And so of course, we would need the home observer as well, because you're not going to compare
the airport with something from another town. Yeah, you'd want to do it somewhere else in La Crosse to make sure. Yeah. That's a good point.
Dave in La Crosse. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Just wanted to mention I got a National Geographic a couple of days ago with a nice detailed map of all the ice loss in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. And some of the largest shelves are moving half a mile or so a year into the Southern Ocean, and some of them are moving much faster than that, the smaller ones. And one detail that caught my mind caught my attention was that there was a 12-fold increase that they measured in fresh water coming out of those glaciers. I just wondered if you folks had seen that.
Yeah, I've been looking at that as well as the ice sheets on the north pole as well, the Arctic ice sheet and the ice that's coming off of Greenland. And Antarctica is really interesting, I think, because, you know, in the northern hemisphere, we have the ice sheet around the Arctic Ocean that freezes, but the ice sheet that's around Antarctica is part, you know, the water freezing, but also the glaciers coming off the Antarctic continent that's underneath it. And so if you start getting more slippage of those ice sheets on the landmass of Antarctica, which is below sea level because all the ice is pushing it down, well, not all of it, but some of it, it causes those ice sheets to move further out and faster, which makes it look like you're getting ice growth. It's really a fascinating glaciology.
Yeah, it really is. The whole migration and behavior of these things is on such a huge scale, but influenced by things that we can talk about at the bus stop, which is really interesting.
And then when they break off, when those ice sheets break off and form those tabular icebergs, you know, they could be the size of Rhode Island and things. I mean, they're just gigantic.
Yeah, I heard the Larsen Sea ice sheet is likely to send one out about that size real soon.
Right, yep. I've been tracking that one as well. And then there's collapses of the ice sheets in the area, like in the Wendell Bay, I think it was called. They had a whole big section there where all of a sudden it becomes Swiss cheese, and then ba-boom, it all just falls apart. It's just, ice is fascinating.
It is. And one of the things that's difficult for us to say, I think, with great certainty is that since we've only had a record of about 40 years from satellites and various other ways of measuring this, not true everywhere, but in some places that are remote, that's about it. It's hard to know for sure if what you're seeing is how unusual it is. It certainly fits into a picture that's, you know, not rosy about how the climate's changing around the globe. However, how unusual it is very difficult to assess.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Let's go to Brad in Spooner next. Hi, Brad.
How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I just tuned in about 3 minutes ago, and I heard you talking about dew point and the old wet bulb thermometers.
Mm.
I'm a retired forest ranger, and we used sling psychrometers to measure relative humidity like every 20 minutes throughout the day, because relative humidity is really critical to us on forest fires. The fire responds with very little change in relative humidity. But if you're looking for those wicks or the old wet bulb sling psychrometers, most forestry suppliers or wildland fire supply catalogs have them.
Oh, that's a good source.
I want to say about 30. So anywhere from $30 to $40 for a set with a little envelope and so forth. So that's, I think, an answer to your question. Now, I have a couple of questions.
Okay.
On those wet bulb thermometers, how often should you change the wick? That would be the first one. And number two, we were always told you had to use distilled water to dip the wick into, which for us on the fire line was hard to do. Mm. So I just dipped it in my water bottle that I drank out of.
I think that's good enough. Yeah, I would say you don't have to worry too much about that. I think if you don't, you probably don't want to put salt water on there. That has a different vapor pressure characteristic, and so that's going to inhibit evaporation and stuff like that. But if it's something that you can drink, I think you're okay. There would be no difference. But it's really interesting question about how frequently you should change the wick. As it turns out, I'm doing a biography of a famous British scientist. His very first publication in a sort of a pedestrian science magazine right after he got his degree was about exactly that question in London. He was working in the London Meteorological Office, and he did a study where he said, I'm not going to change it for a week on this one. I'm going to change it every day on this one. Relative humidity differences were huge, as it turns out. 2 or 3 to 5%.
Really?
Yeah. And, I mean, that sounds small, but it's fairly large, especially large in the forestry setting. So Reggie Sutcliffe's advice would be change it every day because it makes a difference. Yeah.
Okay.
How do you like that?
So is that because it didn't dry out, or what would be in the wick that would?
It's just something about the way that it behaves when it gets re-wetted. It's not the same as being the virginal wetting of a new wick.
Are the wicks, though, the same now as they were back then?
I don't know. That's a good question.
That's a good question.
They're just little cloth, you know, sleeves that you put on the end of the bulb.
Yeah.
And so
yeah,
I don't know.
The other question was I bought like 3 feet of wick back in the mid-1980s, and I still have 3/4 of it left.
There you go.
Yeah, you might be able to sell it.
30, 40 years? Or
there you go.
It's true.
I'd be buying wick, you know, every year or so, do wick, and then get enough to change the bulb, you know, 90 days out of the year.
Wow.
Well, would that wick, I don't know why it wouldn't be, you know, as long as it
depends on where it's being stored now. Because I'm thinking, you know, maybe it's the absorptive properties that change. I mean, it's like your clothes, right? Once you get them wet,
that's true.
They feel different.
And if you're in London in 1928, there's a little bit more smog there than there is now. And there's coal dust and whatnot. Maybe that was a factor. It could very well be.
Yeah, I stuck mine in a file folder and dropped it in the filing cabinet. That's where I've been storing my wick material.
I'd say that's non-standard, but probably okay.
Well, there you go.
All right. Thanks a lot, Brad. Oh, that was good. Barb in Blue Mounds. We'll go to you next. Hi, Barb.
Hello. I'm just wondering why we're having such predictable, interesting days. We get up in the morning, it's clear, it looks like it's going to be a sunny, clear day unless you read the newspaper or something. And then around 11, the clouds come in, and then the wind picks up, and then you've got these weird bursting deluges, and then it's over, and then it comes back.
Mm-hmm.
My brother's theory is that we're pulling up the Gulf air due to climate change, and I just wondered, are we having anomalous weather, or is this just typical June, and I forgot what June was like?
I think it's a typical, you know, in terms of this type of weather, it's a typical June weather. We do get moisture coming up from the Gulf Stream to feed some of our thunderstorms and things, but...
Yeah, and we have what are known as cutoff lows, which are just little pools of relatively cold air in the middle and upper troposphere that are very common, but not uniformly distributed over the Great Lakes from like mid-April to mid to late June. And so the months of May and June can be characterized like this. They don't always look like this, but this is one variety of June that's not so uncommon. And we're certainly having one of those kind of, you know, days where you where the clouds build during the morning as the sun hits the ground and warms it up. And that's a response to the fact that the air above the ground is quite cold, relatively speaking. So we're, you know, northwesterly flow puts us in this kind of a regime in some Junes, and this is one of them.
And it got me yesterday when I was doing my charcoal barbecue.
Oh, is that right?
Me too.
Just as they were just going, the storm develops and boom.
Right. Same for me. Same thing.
My dad took my mother out in a sidecar and didn't put the lid on. He thought this would be okay. And they came back and she was like sitting with water.
Right.
Oh, you're like, Dad, come on.
Well,
anyway,
yeah, right.
Thank you very much.
It happens to us forecasters as well.
Yeah.
Terry in Partyville, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi there. I have a question about water spouts. I fish on Lake Michigan a lot, and not in this year, but other years, we've seen water spouts off in the distance from us, and how are they developed? It didn't appear to have much wind where we were at, so I'm just curious what causes that.
Mm.
Yeah, water spouts look a lot like tornadoes, but they form totally differently. You don't have they're usually not associated with the big thunderstorms that have rotations in them. They get sucked up, if I can use that phrase, by the storm to form what the water spouts look like.
Yeah, so is it just it's just sort of basic wind variability in the
wind
lower part
yeah.
of the boundary layer that
right.
gets organized?
Yeah.
The same way that dust devils or steam devils or something like that kind of get their origin?
Yeah,
yeah.
And some of those dust devils can get really big, too, 1,000 feet tall and things.
And then the advantage for the water spout is it usually is tied to a thunderstorm of some kind, maybe not a severe thunderstorm all the time, but it's got something that helps to organize it better and sustain it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they're scary looking.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
We didn't get anywhere close to it. We kind of got off the water, but it was on Lake Great, in Lake Michigan, and so it was just kind of an interesting, interesting thing to see a couple of these off in the distance from us, and like maybe it's time to go. So
yeah, and you know, actually, it's also a smart move to get off because it is probably associated with a convective storm, which means there's lightning and things in there.
Yeah.
Okay,
and being on water isn't the best place to be.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom in Manitowoc, do you have a quick comment?
I called about the dew point, the sling psychrometer, which I have. It's a Taylor, made by Taylor. But about 60 years ago when I was in junior high, I made a dew point actual measurement unit, which I took a stainless steel test tube, polished it very brightly, put a thermometer inside with some ether, and when you evaporated the ether, you could see the dew forming on the outside, and therefore the dew point was whatever the temperature of the ether was inside. So that was a science project.
Oh,
very clever.
Yeah.
I mean, one way of measuring a dew point accurately now is what's called the chilled mirror.
And so that was the same thing.
The same principle, yeah. Yeah. Did you patent it?
You should have.
Probably didn't think of it back then.
Steve and John are going to steal it when they get home now.
Well,
no, someone else already
did it, so we lost. Right, yeah.
Okay. Tom, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And boy, here we are. So the rest of the summer and 15 seconds or 20 seconds?
Boy, that is a good question. It looks like for the next several days we stay in the regime we have had for the whole summer, you know, and I'm wondering if it isn't going to last longer than that. My colleague Michael Morgan said this in the spring. He said, I think we're in for a cooler than normal summer. Yeah. And so far, I think.
But we've been warmer.
Warmer. Yeah, all right. Then I'm
going
to say.
But going back in March and April, if you look at those, we were near normal.
Right. Anecdotally and by impression, this has been a cool summer. This month of June, despite the fact it's 3.3 degrees warmer than normal, it's been, by impression, cooler. I don't know what comes next, but if the ridge that's made it really warm in the Southwest persists, we stay cool.
John Martin and Steve Ackerman, our weather guys, they'll be back on July 31st. We'll do it all over again. Thank you for listening. Stay with us.